On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. And other boats were with him, and a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was great calm. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and the people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. And they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. And he was getting into the boat. The man who had been possessed with the demons begged him that he might be with them. And he did not permit him, but said, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone marveled. This is God's word.
And now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Well, we're looking at encountering Jesus. And for the disciples, they were encountering Jesus in the book of Mark. The crowds were encountering Jesus in the book of Mark. And we are asking the question for ourselves, what is it like in a time like ours, when people are open to and even seeking to have spiritual experiences, which many people are, where you can go to the store and go down to Bookman's and all of the stuff for sale right up by the register seems to be spiritual, and when there's new metaphysical bookstores popping up all up and down Broadway, and they are, what does it mean in a day like today to have a true and spiritual experience with God? What does that really mean? Here, in this scripture that Jared just read, we have two dramatic encounters in a row, which are actually, there's a series of three, and this is the first two. And in this series of three, we see God having authority in Jesus over the non-human creation, the chaos within the human heart, and then over death itself. Next week, we look at death. So the non-human creation, the chaos within the human person, and then death itself. And these three things happen really quick. And I said to our team this week, I said, you think working at this church is exhausting? You know, we had to like buy some paper towels for the kitchen this week, had to answer a few emails, you know. Some of y'all were early, and so we had to chat it up with you before church. You know, imagine, you know, that I made our whole team get in a boat with me and say, hey, let's go over to Lake Patagonia, you know, and see what's on the other side. And we hopped in there, encountered a really crazy storm. I got up, rebuked the whole thing, and then on the other side, the most demon-possessed man of all demon-possessed men, you know, encountered us, yelled at us. I cast the demons into pigs. They all ran into the lake. And this is all like before dinner. And that's a big day. This was a really wild experience. I mean, these disciples, why is this in the book of Mark? Because this is like some of the craziest stuff they've ever experienced in their lives. And it's terrifying to go through this whole experience, jumping in a boat, big storm, demon-possessed man. Like I said, they're about to encounter somebody who is dead very soon after. I mean, this is a very intense sequence. We've been saying this throughout the series, but it bears repeating that Mark is writing his gospel. So a gospel is good news. He's writing his good news story in an ancient biographical style, which means in an ancient biography, you're not just trying to inform someone or entertain somebody. That's why we read a biography now, right? Somebody's had a very interesting life, and we want to inform them of all the little dirty little details about your life that you can't find out anywhere else, and we want to entertain you. That wasn't what it was for in the ancient world. An ancient biography was so that you could look at the hero or the learner, the one learning a lesson, and ask, how do I emulate them or how do I follow their path? How do I follow the example that I learn in the story? So for us, as we think about this, what does it mean to follow the example we learn in the story? We don't get to be Jesus because he, in this story, is clearly God. So we must be asking, what does it mean to be a disciple? And asking that question, what does it mean to encounter Jesus? Just because Mark's writing this way and trying to get us to ask this question doesn't mean these events didn't happen. It doesn't mean this is just like an exercise that we're going through. In fact, this story in particular has some linguistic clues in it that show us that actually this story would have been in early circulation among Christians. It was probably one of the kind of core verbal stories that was told. There's some old pieces of language in there that really hint at that. That Mark is not making this up. He's drawing from a story that he's hearing. So this story doesn't just have meaning. It happened, but it also means a lot to them because it's a story that they've told over and over. Now, I also must say, we discussed this in our planning session, even within our own Bible, and I'll hammer this a few times today, even within our own Bible, we have similar situations that end very differently. So the Apostle Paul later is going to be in a big storm on the sea. And he does not get the experience of having the storm calmed. In fact, their boat gets torn to shreds, right? Okay? So the sea doesn't get calmed very often. In fact, this seems like the moment right here. If you dig a little into early church history, you have mad people. I once did a paper on Emperor Nero in the Roman world. And this is a man who even his contemporaries, who were, you know, irreligious in our estimation, thought he might be possessed. They thought he was sick. I'm sure the Christians that were praying to be delivered when he was coating them in wax and burning them like candles. Happy Mother's Day, again, by the way, just since we're on the subject. No, like, this is dark, weird stuff, right? He burned people, and I'm sure they were crying out to God, you know, deliver us from this madman, and God did not. So God doesn't cast the evil out of every single person, not even in the Bible, not even in the very early church. The evils aren't always cast into the herd of swine and sent rushing into the river. So this is important. It's important to ask what this means for us, but it is important on the front end to say it's not necessarily going to be your normative experience. Some of us were taught, if you kind of grew up in Christian circles, you might have been taught a surface reading of this, and it would be something to this effect. And this is the easy one to preach. I wish I could. It'd be so much fun. To say, when you're going through hard times and the storm in your life, you know, I can feel the pep in my step just thinking about it. Look to Jesus, you know, and it'll clear up. It'll clear up. But Paul's life soon after, the disciples' lives who are going to die for their faith, all of them are going to be martyred except John, who they attempt to martyr. He's going to be imprisoned on an island. Their lives show us that's not as simple. It's not that simple. It's just not that simple. This story seems to work out in four parts, so I'm going to follow the four parts. Moments when it seems like Jesus doesn't care, what we do when Jesus exhibits his power, what we do when we are asked to consider our faith, which Jesus does do in this text, and then when we have to face the question of who are we dealing with here? Who is this? When it seems like he doesn't care, he exhibits his power, when we consider our faith, and we have to decide who he is and what that means for us. So I'm going to kind of march back through the story. When evening had came, he said to his disciples, let's go across to the other side. So he's been teaching on the side of the Sea of Galilee, okay? And he says, let's go across the other side. And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. And the other boats were with him. So there's several boats. A great windstorm arose. The waves were breaking into the boat, so the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. They woke him and said, teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? This story is in all of what we call the synoptic gospels, which means gospels that are viewed from the same perspective. And so Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John seem like they're kind of telling the story from the same perspective. Sorry, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John is coming from a little different perspective. This story is in all of those three gospels. And then in John, we have one of Jesus walking on the water. So there's something very similar in John. But only in Mark, the earliest, the oldest gospel, do the disciples ask Jesus if he cares. That's one specific difference. And then in Matthew and Luke, they call him Lord or Master. In Mark, and Mark only, they call him Teacher. And this makes some sense because Mark isn't just telling us what this means. He wants us to ask what it means. He wants us to live in the disciples' experience for a second. And to think, what would it be like for this, your teacher, to behave this way before you've decided who you think he is? What it's like to encounter the most profoundly impactful person in your life right now, who you're not, and you're not sure who he is, when it seems like he is asleep, when you are afraid. So here, I said there's a surface way of teaching this. Now, we're getting close to that, but it's different. But I have an even more surface level question to ask, just for the sake of not being anti-surface level, right? How is Jesus asleep in this situation, right? I actually think it's okay to ask these questions of the Bible. How? I didn't sleep last night because my shoulder was sore, okay? Like sort of sore, just bothering me. And like if our dog licks me in the night, I'm up. This is amazing. This is before melatonin. Like, how is he asleep? The boat is filling up with water, people. There's a storm in a, these aren't large boats. And if he's asleep, okay, now let's, if he's asleep, why would the disciples ask him if he cares? No, he doesn't care. He's sleeping right now. Okay. Anyway, I as I thought about that, I remembered one time as a kid, we were traveling across the U.S. in a motorhome. This is a point where big time in my life. My dad has been laid off in the lumber industry. We're looking for a new home. We're going to try living in several states while my dad figures out work. And we had the little bed above the cab of the motorhome, okay? And my parents, not being committed enough to seatbelts, would let me go up in there, up in the... My mom might debunk this. This is my memory of it, Mom. I know you're listening. But in my mind, I'm up in the bunk, okay, above the cab. And we're in this big storm on a bridge stuck in traffic, and the bridge is starting to move, right? And I wake up, because who wouldn't, right? When your whole vehicle is moving on a bridge. And I looked outside and saw the bridge flexing, and I said something to my parents, and they were like, "It's okay, honey. The bridge was made to do that." And I went, okay, back to bed. That's how I remember it. I thought, my parents care about me. They're not lying to me, so I can sleep. You know, I don't know what happened with Jesus here. Maybe he's kind of in that mindset where he's like, yeah, there's a storm. It's going to be fine. Back to bed. I don't know. But that surface level question, which really gets us nowhere, led to a deeper question, which is this. Is it that the disciples are just worried about themselves on the storm, out on the water? Or are they worried about the guy that is sleeping in the boat that's filling up with water right now? I don't know. But entertain that for a second. Jesus is on the cushion in a boat that's filling up with water, and they're trying to like take care of the boat, right? They're trying to figure this out. He's asleep in the stern. And what if this boat gets flipped over? He doesn't know what's going on, and you know, he gets bonked on the head or something like that. Maybe the disciples are scared for Jesus because he's their teacher that they love. They see how popular he's getting. They see that like all their hopes and dreams are getting kind of wrapped up in this guy. Now, what about that? Think about that. Have you ever been scared, not just for you, but for the sake of your faith, like the whole big picture? Like, what about when, like, in our culture, the church is getting a really bad name, and you look at that and you go, is God going to get through this? Like, and that's us believing that Jesus is God, if we're Christians, right? Is God going to be able to pull this thing off? Or is he kind of in danger right now? I wonder if they thought Jesus was in danger. Maybe the disciples were crying out for all of these reasons. Maybe they're afraid for Jesus. Maybe they're asking Jesus, do you not care about us, Jesus? Do you not care about all of us, Jesus? Do you not care about the whole movement? Everything we've started here? Do you not care about any of it? You're just going back to sleep? Now, Mark's point is not about nautical dilemmas and how to get out of them. It really isn't. But it's about these moments where we ask, what do we do with our fear? And what do we do when it feels like Jesus doesn't care? When he is even in danger, when his kingdom is in danger, when his life is in danger, when our lives are in danger, when it's all cracking, what do we do when it feels just feels like Jesus doesn't care? How do we respond? Well, we're sharing short stories this year of our own encounters with Jesus, and sometimes they feel kind of like this moment. And so today, on the early end here, I'm going to have John and Jude come up and share a little bit of their story, a hard story, and it's a brave one to tell on Mother's Day. So thanks for coming up, John and Jude. We appreciate you.
Hey, guys. Wow. Well, I wanted to start by just saying thanks, Andy, for asking us. Thanks, John, Mike, Cruz, all the elders, and all of you mostly. Not mostly, no, but all of you as well, because many of you have been praying for us off and on for the last year since we started hanging out here, and we just wanted to say we really appreciate that. So this is a bit of a hard story. Sure. Well, it was a typical Saturday in August, hot, just like any other Saturday, until it wasn't. Dear JL, dad here. Our world stopped today at 11:20. Mom and I were both working at home when a sheriff's officer came to the door. That moment, everything in our lives changed forever. And we changed. And we will remain changed for the rest of our lives. There must be a mistake, I said. And I still thought and hoped unreasonably, illogically, surely there must be a mistake. The officer that came to the door told us, actually his words were, "Are you John Trang, and do you have a son named John Trang?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I'm sorry to tell you, but your son has died of a heroin overdose."
So JL died. He was 25. He started using oxys in middle school with a friend. This was in the early O's when nobody heard about it. I certainly hadn't heard that kids used that kind of stuff. I only had them after surgeries, you know. So they never thought about addiction, you know, especially at that age. And you don't have any concept of what you're getting into. And then he was hooked. And then he was trapped. And then it was too expensive to buy oxys on the street. And so then he went to heroin, which was a whole lot cheaper. He fought for 10 years for his life. He went in and out of recovery. He was very high functioning, you know, finished high school, was in pre-law at the U of A, but had periods of time where he was just, you know, not able to function. And we didn't understand, you know, and we never heard. Like, nobody was talking about this, no parents. We didn't know other kids had died at school, and there were no public funerals or anything like that. So we just thought he needed to have more willpower. Try harder, you know. So when a friend died on New Year's Eve in 2013, it freaked him out, and he really, really wanted to be free of this and to get clean. So he went through detox one more time, entered a sober living home, was there 6 months through some medicated events. He relapsed and overdosed and died. And, you know, a tragic, untimely death like that really leaves you questioning, especially parents, with regrets, with everything. What the heck did we do wrong? You know, we tried our best. We raised him to know the Lord. But like Jesus' friends, you know, in the middle of the fury of that storm, you have these questions. And we had intense feelings, like, where are you, Lord? You know, we decided from that moment that though we would be totally honest, that we could not speak about our son, because if we didn't speak about him, it was like we were shaming him. So we had complete honesty, and we started writing a journal to him. And we wrote together every day for a year.
This is October 6th of 2015. Yeah, over a year past his death in August. JL, I continue to have many nights with little sleep. Last night I was up from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. I sat next to your picture and your ashes. I read from the journal that we wrote a year ago. It was sweet in many ways to remember the intensity of our feelings, but mostly bittersweet. Shock, numbness, anger, regret, heartache, physical pain, in our hearts, and deep, profound sadness. Despite the pain of rereading about our journey after you died, I'm so happy that Mom and I actually recorded our thoughts and feelings. Mom's thinking about writing this as a memoir. A good friend has encouraged her to do this, and I think it would be great.
A verse from Isaiah 43, you know, everybody's pretty familiar with it. When you walk through these things, not if, but when you pass through the waters, when they walk through the rivers, when they rage, I will be with you. They won't overflow you. When you go through the fire, you will not be burned, for I am the Lord, your God, your Savior. So we had these feelings, just like the disciples. I can totally relate to them. Like, what the heck? How could you possibly be asleep? But, you know, what did Jesus's followers do with their feelings? I know people that, it's a lot of times with Christians, it's like, you know, don't say those things, you know, have faith, you know, have faith. Well, it's like, I have faith, but the disciples, you know, they didn't jump into the sea. They didn't despair and go, oh my gosh, let's just drown or try to swim back to shore on our own. They needed Jesus, and so they went to Jesus. And I think that's the thing for us. You know, we ask, don't you care? Don't you love us? Don't you love JL? But, you know, as we worked and we slogged through our grief, we shared our story and we told people how God kept us sane when a lot of times we really thought we weren't going to stay sane, how he kept us together. A lot of friends said to us, you know, when a child dies, a lot of parents split up. And I think that that... we had some other friends that were pondering divorce, and they said to us later, when we saw that you stayed together through your son's death, we figured if you can stay together through that, then we can. We have nothing to compare to that. So, and God kept us hopeful that we'll see JL someday. That's our hope.
So it was a big storm. We felt overwhelmed. I couldn't even believe that time was continuing without JL in it here. But Jesus, as we're going to get to, spoke to the wind and calmed the seas that raged all around us. And through songs, through our friends, through JL's friends, and through his living word, Jesus spoke words of life into our heart. The words that he gave me that sustained me during those early months and up to this very day, if the Son sets you're free indeed. And our son was a really, really great guy, and it was great to hear all of his friends tell us how much they loved him and how important he was in their lives. And he had struggled. He did not want to be addicted. We all experience storms in our lives. Some of the storms are mild and some are severe. And if we're honest with ourselves, we probably are all struggling with some kind of an addiction, possibly many addictions. And we're just thankful. He'd be 35 now. It was his birthday in March. It's going to be 10 years this August. If the Son sets you're free indeed. The last enemy that's destroyed is death. I am the resurrection and the life. These words that he spoke sustain us to this day.
Well, and if you haven't gotten the idea, John and Jude have, well, huge hearts that God has given them in light of this. And so they want you to know if you need to talk about anything like that going on in your own lives, they'd love to be a place where you start. So know that as Jesus has been at work in their lives, they're happy to offer from what they've journeyed through and remember their son well. So yeah, the storms, right? Like it's real. And sometimes it doesn't seem to go away. And there you are looking at Jesus saying, what are you doing? For these disciples out on the sea, they saw his power. It says, Jesus awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, peace, be still. And the wind ceased and there was a great calm. A similar word we came across a while back was when he cast out the first demon in the book of Mark. It was a similar word for like muzzling an animal. It's actually a very terse word that he says to the wind and the waves, and they obey him. I guarantee you the disciples expected something a little less than this. The response you expect when you're trying to wake up the guy that's asleep on the cushion with the water sloshing around him is that he would wake up and start getting involved, right? They're thinking, Jesus, you know, scoop water out of the boat, you know, like just get involved and get ready to swim. That's probably what they were thinking. But instead, Jesus stands up and scolds wind and water like you talk to an animal. Isn't that interesting? Like we say to our dogs, what did we say like 50 times yesterday when all Abby's friends were coming over? Shut your mouth. You know? It's that's what he did to weather. And in this moment, it's like one of those pinch yourself moments where you go, if you're a disciple in the boat, this is not what you had in mind. You're going, huh? Huh? It stopped? It's too fantastic. It's unbelievable. It's one of those things where people say, when people read the Bible skeptically and say, this didn't happen, I get it. I totally do. Because there's only one way that happened. We have to go further here beyond just how crazy it is that you could talk to weather like you talk to an animal. Tumultuous bodies of water are scary to everybody. Fun fact, if you live in Tucson, Arizona, there are more people in this state that own boats than anywhere else in the United States, I hear. I'm one of them. It doesn't make any sense. Mine does not operate, nor do most of them. But if I'm out on my little boat in a body of water, I kind of know what to expect, even though I'm no nautical expert, right? I know what's down there. If I'm in the ocean, I know there could be a shark. I know there could be a reef. I know there could be seaweed, right? I know that. If I'm in a lake, there's some kind of mud and grasses and some bass. I know that because I know what's underwater. These people do not know what's underwater. You have to think about this. They have seen no underwater photos. They do not go scuba diving. This is entirely unknown. And in the ancient world, it's beyond unknown. They'd spiritualized it. And they had stories of monsters and alien creatures. And for all they knew, the depths of it never ended and just went down, down, down. Because the earth back then, they didn't know was round. Okay? This is all in the ancient world, this is an utterly chaotic space, and it was. I mean, you can look at ancient writing and imagery of the sea, and it is a terrifying place to them. In the ancient world, the sea is chaotic, the most chaotic place in the non-human creation that cannot be tamed by mankind. So outside of the Jewish people, right, the Greeks, who tames the sea? It's Poseidon and Triton. It's the gods, right? And in the Jewish mind, it's the creator is the one who can calm the waters. And actually the creation narrative starts with waters and they don't know what's under them. And the Spirit of God is hovering over them and then commands them to separate. That's the first part of their story. Gods do this stuff, right? So what does it mean for the man asleep on the cushion to wake up and stand and speak to the wind and the sea like he's commanding an animal? It means that this man must either speak for or be a god. That's what it means. That's the dilemma. This man must be either speaking for or he must be a god. This is a moment when the disciples and the reader are faced with the question, right? Who is this? And that is what it says. Who then is this? And then it's no accident that the next scene is this. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs, a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs. No one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, broke the shackles into pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he fell down and or ran and fell down before him. This is the next scene immediately, right? So we've encountered another demon-possessed person in Mark, actually a couple times, but we hear a lot more information about this one. And the reader has to ask, why is that? Why is there so much detail? And there are a couple reasons for this. Number one, this is a notoriously demon-possessed man. This is a demon-possessed man who isn't just troubled. This dude is crazy and terrifying and known about, right? Like, if you live among the tombs in this time, like, you are wild. He can't be bound, even with chains, screaming, slashing himself with stones. This is a notorious person. And the spirit within him knows who Jesus is. That's something. So all in one evening, Jesus speaks to the storm like he's talking to an animal. And then this man comes crashing in front of him and cries out with a loud voice. It says, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" What's the question the disciples just asked? Who is this man? There's their answer, coming from the demon-possessed man. And he said, "I adjure you by God," he's making all these connections, "do not torment me," for Jesus was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." You have this sense that they're like talking at each other, right? He's bowing down, begging him. Jesus is like commanding again. It's like, whoa, what is happening here? So Jesus just spoke to weather and it listened. Now he's talking to the most chaotic human being any of them have ever heard of, which is why he gets this long description. And the demon is having a dialogue with him. This is crucial to Mark's gospel that you understand how possessed this man is and just how serious this is. But another thing is crucial as well, because they're moving toward the Decapolis. This place gets named. And so they're now moving out of Jewish territory and into pagan territory, where people aren't believers in the one true God. They're moving across the sea out of Jewish territory into pagan territory. So not only is the story about this, you know, this man can speak to the weather, but this man can speak to the spirits who are outside of God's people. And they know who he is. This is incredible. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion." Now, this is interesting. He is speaking, this is Roman military terminology, and it begins to take over the whole rest of the story. So legion, the word we read is herd for pigs. Jared could probably confirm this. Pigs don't really like live in herds. It's actually the word for like a troop of soldiers. And then when they asked his permission, it was the word you'd use to ask a commander of an army for permission. It turns into military language. The demons are talking to him like he's commander. It's very interesting. "What is your name?" "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out into the country where many spirits were at work, out of the country. And now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us into the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission. The unclean spirits came out, entered the pigs and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. This is a wild scene. I've got a couple artistic images of it. But now they go into the sea. Jesus and the disciples just came out of the sea, and Jesus just spoke and calmed the sea, right? And now these spirits want out of the man so they can keep doing their business. He throws them in back into the sea. It's pretty incredible. He's rebuked the sea, saying, "Peace, be still," and now these spirits are listening to him. And even when they beg him for mercy, he's outwitted them. So now what are the disciples faced with? Jesus, who was asleep in our boat, who seemed like he didn't care, is speaking to the chaos outside of us, and that's not all. He's speaking to the chaos inside of the most chaotic people in the world. He spoke to the most chaotic element of creation. He's spoken to the most notoriously possessed man that they can imagine. And the spirits within him are begging him for mercy. In the ancient world, these are the prime chaotic forces, the next of which will be death, which is the next thing Jesus will speak to. You'll hear about it next week. So you have to ask these questions, like what are the core chaotic forces? That was in the ancient world. What about in our world? Like when you think about what could God not control, what feels most out of control, you as somebody asking what it would be like to encounter a God who feels like he's asleep, now you have to ask, what does it feel like to face chaos? What to me seems like it's outside of even God's control? And then we have to look at our own faith. So Jesus said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" Now, this is the point where we can miss the point. This is what I was getting at earlier. This is where you can read this and think, if I had more faith, this wouldn't have happened. This is where it's tempting, where John and Jude could have felt these things, right? And you do think that kind of stuff. If I had done this right, if I'd believed God and done this right, this would not have happened. Is that what this means? That children wouldn't die or struggle in life, that natural disasters wouldn't happen? This is why, like, you know, a big storm hits New Orleans, and what do people start saying? They go, "Oh, they party down in New Orleans," right? Big storm hits somewhere else. What a tragedy. Why do we do that? We have this thing that goes on within us where we're like, is it really about us and our behavior and our faith? And is God punishing us with all this stuff? That those we love wouldn't deal with demons or inner chaos if they believed enough. This is why we Christians can sometimes struggle to admit the issues that we face. Because if we admit we face those issues, it sounds like we don't have faith, even to ourselves. Are we admitting? Are we okay with telling the truth if that means we don't have faith? Now, that is not the point. Remember I said earlier, Paul, the great apostle, he's going to be in a terrible storm that Jesus does not calm. The Christians are going to be marched before the pagan Roman Empire, fed to the beasts inside of the Colosseum. And Jesus isn't going to cast the demons out of the people doing that to them. The surface reading doesn't square with history or even the New Testament. And sometimes when we apply that kind of thinking, it just leads us to one of three things. You either get discouraged that you don't have enough faith, or if you did get the miracle, a pride that says, "I got it because I had more faith than them," or denial of the truth, where you go, that's what it would mean to have faith. It's not happening to me, so I'm just not going to tell you what really happened. So if we don't want to go down that road, and I'm encouraging that we don't, how do we understand this? Well, it's important for us to remember that the disciples would look back and recognize something in this event, a very important layer of this event. So I have to ask you, when in the scriptures and in their history, was there a great teacher who was called to cross the sea to the pagan world? When was there a great teacher who fell asleep in their boat when a great storm came upon the sailors, right? When there was an empire that God was trying to save, and the great teacher was on the seas, and the storm was calmed. Anybody remember? Yes, you're good. Jonah. They would have thought of Jonah. When you read this story, and even the people reading Mark's biography, they're thinking of Jonah. This sounds like Jonah. It's similar to Jonah, but not quite the same. Because how did Jonah calm the storm? Jonah knew how to calm the storm. Throw me overboard, right? I'm the problem. He's the teacher. Jonah's the teacher called by God, but he's running from God, but he embodies the problem. He's emblematic of all of God's people. When you read Jonah, you're supposed to think not Jonah stinks. You're supposed to think I'm like Jonah. Okay? He's like us. The chaos was within him too, right? So to get the problem to be solved, you have to get him out. But this man, Jesus, he stands and he speaks to the wind and the waves. And when the disciples look back and reflected at Mark's invitation, they see this: someone greater than Jonah has come. That's what they would think. Someone greater than Jonah has come. In Jesus, we don't just have a great teacher, and that's why Matthew and Luke switch it to Lord and Master. Because Mark is getting us to think about what our early appraisal of Jesus. Matthew and Luke have already decided this is the Lord and Master. They agree with the demon-possessed man that he's the captain. So if that's the case, if the greater one than Jonah has come, now, and these are not my words, but this would be a very true statement, and this has been said throughout the Christian church for a long time. It isn't the strength of your faith that's going to save you. It's the object of your faith that's going to save you. It's not the strength of your faith that's going to save you, like knowing for sure and all that. It's the object of your faith that's going to save you. That's what Mark is trying to show you. The greater one has come. Jesus is not saying muster up more faith, and if you look around at the storm, it'll all calm down. It's not the power of positive thinking. It's not manifesting your spiritual dreams. He's saying, I am with you. And I am greater than you. I am who you've been waiting for. The one who commanded the waters together where they do at creation. The one who formed us out of the dust and breathed the breath of life, the human spirit, into us, came into our midst. So chaos does not get the last word. So you don't endure any storm by believing that if you muster up enough faith, you can get through it. You endure any storm by realizing who is with you. In next week's sermon, as I said, Jesus goes after death. That's the next great miracle of Jesus, and the order is significant because in every single thing we face, he is with us. If the one who made the seas entered in and endured the chaos in creation, the chaos within us, when we turned against him, when Roman and Jewish people turned against him and subjected him even to death itself and he overcomes it, then nothing can stand between us and the one who made us. Nothing. So you intuit the next point, right? We have to decide who Jesus is. That's what Mark is getting at. You have to decide who Jesus is. You have to be confronted with this story and decide who is Jesus. That's the big question. Our text here says the disciples were filled with great fear, and they said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" In the span of this evening, these disciples go from being afraid for Jesus, this is words of the great philosopher Mike Almaroth who pointed this out, to standing in fear of Jesus. Right? They're afraid for themselves and for Jesus, and all of a sudden now they're afraid of Jesus. In a good way, to quote Jordy, right? That's a Jordy quote, I think. In just a day or so, right, the pagan religions, the pagan regions of the Decapolis go from not knowing who Jesus is at all to having the first missionary in their midst telling them about Jesus. That happens. If you remember, it said this, the herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country. Now think about this. Their encounter with Jesus is a mixed bag. They just lost all their pigs. It's like I was thinking about what would be a parallel. It'd be like you're driving along and you see there's a little girl who's about to get hit. And you go, oh no. And you see this car coming at her. And you're like, no. And you see the car is like, it's almost like an angel pushed the car. You're like, oh, she's saved. And then it comes crashing into your car. And your whole car is destroyed and you have to go to the hospital. And you're like, well, I'm glad the little girl is saved, but I just lost my car. But, you know, I think I'm okay with it. Like, that's where they're like, I'm really glad this crazy guy's better, but I just lost 2,000 pigs. So they go run into their country and they tell people what happened, and all these people come in. It says people came to see what had happened. So that now the time is slowing down. People are starting to gather in from these cities. They came to Jesus, it says, and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and the pigs, and they began to beg Jesus to depart from the region. Okay, the idea that God is in our midst can vary or can yield varied results. It can lead to what the disciples experienced. And I have a couple of art pieces here to kind of exhibit this. So this is an old mosaic of this moment, right? And you have Jesus, as the old mosaics do, symbolized by, you know, a sign for holiness around his head. And he's, and what's he doing? He's pointing to the guy, and he's kind of doing, he's like, look what I did, you know? Here's the guy, no longer crazy. And the pigs, I like how 2,000 is three, because in a mosaic, doing 2,000 pigs would be really difficult. And then the disciple over here is like, this, I think, means cool. Like, I think that's what that means, like, sick, you know? Way to go, Jesus. But this is symbolic of the disciples' journey, where you see what Jesus has done and you respond positively. You go, wow, I'll worship you. Like, oh, wow, you are greater than I thought you were. The one who's greater than Jonah is in our midst, right? And then there's this artistic depiction of it, right, that I showed you earlier. And so here, it's interesting, where are Jesus and the disciples? They're not in the picture, right? The man is still kind of like, it's almost as if it's just happened, but the man who is possessed is alone, interestingly, and the herdsboy and the animal are running scared. So I think it's positioning. I think there's a reason that the pigs are black and the dog is white. I think it's on purpose that there's one person running, one person, you know, just almost like, I don't know, they've just been healed. They're just laying there. It's two different responses to Jesus. It's two different responses to what happened. One goes, I don't want to have anything to do with that. And the other one is just receptive. I'm just laying here. I'm just receiving what Jesus gave to me. I think those two images actually paint the picture of how people are going to respond to Jesus. Sometimes you'll see his power and it leads to saying, okay, no matter what I've been through, I accept you are God. And other people are going to see it and it's going to disrupt their way of life. And they might say, I don't want this around me. This is too much. This demands too much. What Jesus does in the midst of being rejected here is really interesting. So the herds people reject him, right? Get out. Would you leave? Would you please leave? I think this is a really important thing to say, because we're culturally in a moment like this, where in a post-Christian culture, Jesus is often rejected, and people often will say, even if they see something incredible, they'll go, I don't know if I want that in my life. Even if they see their friends whose marriage stays together through tumultuous times, they might go, I'm intrigued by that. I don't know, though. That requires a lot. And I think we have to ask, in the midst of a moment like that, what does Jesus do? How does he respond to that? To being rejected by some, accepted by others. This is what happens. In Israel, Jesus was always telling people, when the demon-possessed man happens in the synagogue, he says, don't tell anybody. He's always saying, don't tell anybody. But here, it's different. As he was getting into the boat, the man who'd been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. He's utterly transformed. He wants to be a disciple. He wants to be with Jesus, right? And Jesus did not permit him, but said, go home and tell your friends how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis, this very diverse and actually very secular part of that part of the world, how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. See, Jesus had been telling people not to share who he was in Israel, and he'd been teaching the crowds in parables that they couldn't understand, and this is a turning point moment. He crosses the sea. Theologians see this. He crosses the sea, and now it's public. And now it's among the Gentiles, the people who aren't the in-group, the outsiders. To the outsiders, he sends the transformed person on a mission with a simple and compelling story, which is Jesus has had mercy on me. Mark is showing us here what's going to lead into his own ministry and why he's writing his gospel, because he doesn't write his gospel to Jewish people. He's telling us, here's where Jesus turned things and made a significant call on our lives, and he sent us out into the world. He's signaling that here. And he's saying this redemptive power isn't just for insiders. It's meant to draw all types of people. And in a day when our culture has rejected Jesus, we need to know that Jesus' heart is to draw them to himself with his mercy. And they might just get that at the deepest level, even if a lot of people say, that's too demanding for me. Get out. Some today are promoting that Christians should retreat from secular culture to stay pure. Others are saying that we should stay in the midst of secular culture and fight for power. This is a moment where Jesus shows us what to do. He delivers a man from a legion of demons in a very dark part of the world, and he sends him into his culture as a witness to the mercy of God. And Mark would have heard about that later, and he included it in his book and gave it a lot of time and space to help us see people began to marvel at the message of Jesus. It's transformative, okay? So I said the big question is, who is this? The big question is, who is this Jesus? If the Creator entered into the creation, if the God who made the seas entered into time and space and commands the seas and the wind, if the maker of our hearts can free us from bondage, if the giver of life can awaken us from death, then deciding who Jesus is of utmost importance, because he needs to be the center of our lives. We have to decide that. Even if he takes away, if he takes away our livelihood, that's what happened with the herdsmen. If he takes everything away, is he the one we're going to worship? Because he's the better Jonah who was thrown into death that we might be saved. This table is a reminder of that very moment, that not too long later, and Mark is queuing us up for this story, that Jesus is going to set his disciples down on a holiday when they're remembering all the goodness of God and how he delivered them out of Egypt, and he's going to prepare them for his arrest. He's going to prepare them for his death, and he's going to say, "This is my body broken for you." And they're going to watch him enter into the chaos like Jonah. He's going to be thrown in, even though he is the one who commands the winds and the waves. They're about to watch that, and they're going to have to ask, what does it mean that the one who commands the chaos is being thrown into the chaos, right? He takes the wine from their table, where the wine could represent judgment. It did in many of their ways of thinking, but it also was what they had at the wedding feast. It could represent the joy that stands before them, and he said, "This is my blood poured out for the forgiveness of many." It has this deep double meaning. I'm about to take on the judgment, but I'm preparing a place for you. And he said, the next time I drink of this is when I drink it anew with you in my kingdom. See, his disciples, he's preparing them to understand who he is and what he's doing. And that's what we have to decide, each one of us. The invitation to the table today is to decide in our hearts. If you've decided in the past, great. It's a good time, though, to reassert that, to teach it again to your soul. If you haven't decided, this is the day to consider it. Who is this Jesus? Not that he solves all the problems, but what does it mean that he can and he will, right? And then, as we leave the table, and you'll see that some of us will line up here to take the Lord's Supper as we sing. And as you leave the table, you need to consider, what is he sending us into? Why does he need us to see who he is and understand that? What does it mean to be his witnesses? We're all here because he crossed the sea and went into the Decapolis. That's why all we are here. So will we go out and tell people what we've seen and we've heard? All of you who've been telling stories are practicing that. It's not everything was clean and simple. It's I met the one who speaks to the wind and the waves. Okay. We come to him by faith, and we're sent by him into our world. Right now, I'm going to pray for us and just give you 2 minutes of silence to pray about these things, to examine your heart around these things. So today, a great way of taking this confession time would be to ask, who is he? At the core, who is this? If that's a new thought for you, wonderful. Ponder these things. If that's a question you've answered 1,000 times, ask it again. Look to him, marvel at what he can do, at how he can sustain us through anything. After that, 2 minutes of silence, we're going to do 3 things we always do together. We'll take the Lord's Supper. I've described how that works. We're going to do giving. Giving here is a response to the generosity of God. This is like supposed to come from that worship moment, right? Remember, I said it's not the strength of your faith that saves you. It's not how many checks you write either, by the way. But it is the question of who is this? If this is the God who's created everything and given me everything, then we want our whole lives to be about his mission. So that giving is asking that question of your pocketbook, okay? And then we're going to sing. And the singing is meant to just take these truths and sink them down into the core of who we are so that we remember, all right? So pray with me, and we'll enter into a time of prayer together and then a time of, contemplating who he is and what he's done. Father, thank you for this church. Thank you for the people here. We're so grateful for the gift of hearing John and Jude's heart for their son. And God, even in that, I think about just what a beautiful picture they painted for us of your heart for all of us. You watch us in our troubles and our pain and our death, and you love us, and you long to be with us eternally, and you are an incredible parent. On a day like Mother's Day, we want to come to you and just say, you are the epitome of everything we've been looking for in our families, in our friendships, in our culture, and we need you. So speak to our hearts and lead us now as we pray.